This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a new charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. It's Thursday afternoon, the 26th of August. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is going to be with us for the next few minutes. How has the media been covering the debate, the conflict now, in Lower Manhattan over the proposed building of a mosque near Ground Zero? What I've been seeing is just kind of a lot of coverage of the protests on both sides. Time magazine says it's Islamophobia. Also, we'll be talking with her. She's written recently in Christianity Today magazine, in her Throwing Inkwells column, about the name Jesus Christ not getting honorable mention, but a lot of other kind of mention. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is a writer in Washington, D.C. She's a contributor to GetReligion.org. She writes a column for Christianity Today magazine. It's called Throwing Inkwells. And she's also written a recent article for the Washington Post titled Reporters Should Address American Concerns About Islam. Molly, welcome back.
It's nice to be here.
Did Time magazine get this one right? It's obviously a huge story, but they essentially say that the story is a now growing Islamophobia among Americans.
Yeah, the most recent cover of Time is headlined something like, "Does America have a problem with Islamophobia?" or "Is America Islamophobic?" And it's funny because if you read the actual article, they fail to provide really any evidence of the claim. You don't need to when you have such a blatant headline like that. But there's a confusion about whether concern about certain teachings of Islam is the equivalent of Islamophobia. So Time magazine, as quote-unquote proof of this growing problem, cited a poll that showed that 46% of Americans believe Islam is more likely than other faiths to encourage violence against non-believers. And it's totally possible that that's evidence of Islamophobia, I suppose, but it's also possible that it's just evidence of, you know, an ability to read the newspaper. You have stories coming out all the time about certain parts of the world or certain individuals in this country who claim that they are motivated to violence by their religious beliefs, and those beliefs, you know, being related to Islam or being their own interpretation of Islam. And so, you know, there are studies showing that there was a poll that came out like 3 weeks ago from Pew Forum showing that 3 out of 4 Pakistanis believes that conversion from Islam should be punishable by death. You know, there are stories about, you know, the Europeans who criticize Islam who were violently killed on the street, like Theo van Gogh. There are the stories about the riots that resulted in many deaths and arson, or, you know, fire bombings and whatnot related to the drawings of the Muhammad cartoons. So again, saying that you think Islam, you know, might encourage certain believers to violence more than other religions is not in any way proof of, you know, of bigotry or Islamophobia. It could just be awareness of what's going on in the world.
To be fair, there was also some media coverage of President Barack Obama's comments on the mosque, where he was said in some media outlets to fully endorse the building of the mosque. He was trying to clear that up. What's the story there?
Well, it was interesting. One of the criticisms I had was that both sides are being portrayed as a little bit more extreme than they are. So people who say that they think it's disrespectful to build a $100 million Islamic center 2 blocks from Ground Zero are portrayed as bigots, even if they don't think that the government should do anything about it, and the vast majority do not think that the government should step in. They're just trying to express their concern. And then likewise, when President Obama reaffirmed the First Amendment rights of all Americans, including Muslims, he was characterized as having, like, strongly endorsed and, you know, valiantly defended the project. And he had to come out and go, well, I didn't actually talk about the wisdom of the project. I just was talking about what the government has to say. And he was right on it. And if you portray these two sides in the most extreme way possible, it makes it seem like Americans are further apart on this issue than they probably are.
So is this just kind of taking the easiest route on a story? Because you got protesters screaming in each other's faces, cursing at one another, They're on the New York streets. And I think for a reporter, the easiest thing is to focus on that aspect of it rather than what the real story is here or the broader concerns that Americans have about Islam in our midst.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's a really difficult story to cover. And for a really long time, everyone was very sensitive to the idea that it would be dangerous to kind of explore some of these beliefs in Islam. And, you know, you had President Bush talking all the time about how Islam was nothing other than a religion of peace. And it just kind of became the politically correct thing to do, that you could never explore what the actual beliefs of Islam were. And it's difficult to do it. I mean, there are language barriers, there are cultural barriers. It's so much easier to investigate what Newt Gingrich said than to get a translator to investigate what the imam behind the project has said. And it's much easier to demonize Newt Gingrich than it is to demonize someone who the media are trying to present as a moderate cleric, and who in fact might be a moderate cleric, but who still says things that are deeply, deeply controversial and probably wouldn't go over well with most Americans. And it's just a difficult story to tell, and a lot of reporters don't have time to tell it, and they don't have the resources to tell it, and so they're just falling into the lazy trap of investigating the people who oppose the mosque rather than giving Americans what they really want, which are some answers about how well Islam works in America and whether Muslims can accept our very Western ideas about religious tolerance and freedom of religion.
This comment comes from Mike in Rockford, Illinois, via Facebook. He says, I think Molly makes a great point. People can be opposed to the mosque simply because they think it's in poor taste and offensive to build it in that location, not a blanket opposition or hatred of Islam. The media have misunderstood this opposition on purpose, he says, just because it makes for a better story. The real story, as she mentions, is who will pay for this mosque. With so little money raised, this seems more like a publicity stunt than a legitimate building proposition. All the hype is probably helping fundraising efforts in another part of the world. Your thoughts there?
I think that's probably true. There's been a lot of speculation about whether this was ever a legitimate idea. I mean, $100 million is a lot of money, and raising those funds would be very difficult, particularly if you're not going to take money from some of the more controversial Muslim areas like Saudi Arabia and whatnot. And I think the reporter should just ask, now, where are you going to get this money, and who's got an interest in seeing this built? You know, it'd be hard for any religious group to build something of that size, and it would be interesting to find out, you know, no matter what religious group we're talking about, where that money comes from and what it represents for the people who are giving the money. I think that probably a mosque of an Islamic center of this size would mean different things to different Muslims. You know, just exploring what those things are and how it would be interpreted by the people who give the money. I mean, these are all really interesting and good ideas for news stories, but nobody seems to really be working on that very much right now.
You have also written recently in your Throwing Inkwells column about the rising use of the Lord's name, not in the best sense. Jesus Christ is getting a lot of mention, but it's not honorable mention. What did you find?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to me, and anyone who knows me knows that I struggle with my own problems with cussing, but I've been shocked at how much I see the taking of, you know, people uttering the words Jesus Christ or using the name God and not in a respectful fashion, and it almost seems mainstream now. I was reading something in the New Republic where this totally legitimate journalist used the phrase, you know, who took the Lord's name in vain to talk about something in the healthcare bill. And it just seems like it's getting even more prevalent than I thought it could when I started noticing it a couple years ago. And it's just doesn't make for excellent public discourse.
You also point out in your column, and this is something that probably many Christians wouldn't connect as part of the system of dots here, that the 16th century reformer Martin Luther said that there's a kind of lesser known but most egregious breaking of this commandment against using the Lord's name. What did Luther say?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people think that the commandment about taking the Lord's name in vain really deals with cussing or swearing, and that, you know, may have very little to do with it. It has much more to do with respecting God and his word and his teaching. He reveals who he is to us by his name and his actions, and when we speak incorrectly about that, that's the really grievous taking of that commandment. When we preach false doctrine, accept false doctrine, and it can happen in any number of churches in any number of different ways. That is the thing we should be on guard against.
What is it, do you think, a symptom of? A coarsening of our language seems too simple an answer. Perhaps the fact that now at least in the social sense, we feel at liberty to speak a name that was once reserved for sacred use. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I think that you know, it does definitely signify the secularization of our society. We certainly don't fear God like he has taught us to. And it's also, I think, that, you know, Christians don't speak up like they should about respect for God and for our Savior.
Is it made worse at all, you think, Molly, by the fact that even for Christians, nothing's sacred? Christians have lost a sense of the sacred themselves?
Yeah, I think that it's even, you know, you see it in the way that sometimes people worship, thinking that it's all about how to make things most comfortable. And what does that say about how we view God when we aren't even being reverential in our worship? You know, why should you be reverential in your casual discourse if you can't even be reverential in your worship?
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is a writer in Washington, D.C. She's a contributor to GetReligion.org. She writes a column for Christianity Today called Throwing Inkwells. You'll find a link to Throwing Inkwells and also a recent column she wrote for the Washington Post titled Reporters Should Address American Concerns About Islam under the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to round off today's Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, the 26th of August. We're talking about personhood theory. It sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like it might even be a step in the right direction if people are willing to concede at some point the unborn is a person. The problem is separating personhood from being human is a slippery slope that doesn't do the unborn any good at all. In fact, it is now the theory du jour among those who want to consider the unborn human but not persons worthy of legal protection. We'll talk with Colleen Carroll Campbell about that right after this.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a new charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
You'll find the reformer Martin Luther's thoughts on Jesus' high priestly prayer and the passion and resurrection according to John in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, Luther's Works, Volume 69. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Luther's Works, Volume 69 by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Luther's Works, Volume 69, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. on-demand audio available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org and click Listen On Demand.
Will your church be one of the Issues Etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues Etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues Etc. 300, click the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues Etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues Etc. 300.